right, now that the possibility of international travel is back on the cards from the start of next month, you may be mulling over the possibility of booking a summer vacation, whether you're considering a shot left within our local borders or a trip further afield. You'll want to, of course, make sure that you're doing it in the very best of health and taking any precautions to prevent ill health from ruining your holiday. So, this morning on Doctor's Surgery, we're taking your calls and questions on any travel-related health concerns that you might have. The numbers that you need to get in touch are open line 021 446 0567. The SMS line is 31567 and the WhatsApp 072 567 1567. No Dr. Shah this week. He's on a well-earned break, but we are joined by Dr. Ibrahim Dandria, who is an emergency medical specialist and head of unit at Life Vincent Pilotti. Very good morning to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Morning. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, since lots of people will be looking at travelling internationally and therefore getting on a plane, I wanted to start with DVT, or deep vein thrombosis, which always comes up when we have these conversations. Who's at risk and what causes it?
Okay, so DVT, or deep vein thrombosis, is a condition where you get a blood clot that develops in the veins, usually from the legs. And the risk with DVT is that it can shoot a blood clot off to the lungs, which can stop the heart, causing sudden death. The problem with DVT is that it develops as a result of usually long, cramped flights. So whether it be a bus trip or a plane flight, where a person's sitting immobile for a long period of time, the blood coagulates in the legs and then causes the clot. The patients that are mostly at risk are particularly patients who have underlying malignancies, patients who are older, and patients who have certain hereditary blood clotting conditions. So someone who's had a clot before would be at higher risk for developing a DVT while traveling.
So how is it diagnosed? I mean, if you're saying that it's, you know, it sort of appears and heads towards the lungs, how do you necessarily know that you've got it?
Generally, if a person has developed a DVT, one of the first symptoms would be pain or swelling in one of the limbs.
Right.
So you'd feel that your calf, it might just feel like it's stiff, that you've been, feel like you've walked 1,000 steps, but for no reason because you haven't. And usually it'll be one side will be worse than the other side. So it'll be a unilateral pain or swelling on the legs. The way that we diagnose it in the hospital is with an ultrasound. So we use ultrasound to determine whether the veins are collapsing or not collapsing. And if the veins are not collapsing, that shows that there's a clot in the vein, which will confirm the diagnosis.
Okay. So for people who perhaps will be taking long-haul flight or traveling a considerable distance in a bus, for example, what do they need to do? Will popping an aspirin help, and when should one do that?
Yeah, so I think before one talks about taking aspirin or medication, it's important to just look at general environmental factors that one can use to avoid developing a clot. So the first thing is maintaining good hydration and trying as far as possible to keep mobile during the journey. Simple things, for example, can be every 2 hours or so to get up and just do a quick walk down the aisle of the aeroplane or on the bus. If that's not possible, one can just do foot exercises while seated, flexing and extending the feet and squeezing the calf muscles to try and stop the blood from just sitting there for too long and causing a clot. One can also, if one is a high-risk patient, purchase DVT stockings at your local pharmacist, which keeps the veins compressed and prevents clots from developing. So I think those are important things to do before just relying on a tablet or a pill.
And should we all be doing that, Dr. Dandria? Should we all be popping the stockings on? Should we all be taking a walk up and down, regardless of what our risk profile might be?
Yeah, I think keeping hydrated and taking a walk is something that everybody could do, and doing exercises while seated. Mm. I don't know that stockings are necessary for everybody. I'd probably recommend that more for patients that are in a higher risk category.
Right.
And then again, taking the aspirin. Aspirin is pretty safe. People take it for headaches all the time. But obviously, if you've got stomach problems or ulcers, and that aspirin can aggravate that. Mm. But failing that, you know, taking a Dispirin or half a Dispirin a day before the flight, the day of the flight, and the day after can assist with preventing DVTs.
Okay, good news. According to the World Health Organization, traveler's diarrhea is by far the most common health problem associated with travel. Is there any way that we can prevent it if we're going somewhere where perhaps you wouldn't necessarily want to drink the water or et cetera, et cetera? What's the best way? I guess in this case, prevention's probably better than a cure.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, nowadays it's actually redundant advice. Everyone is so primed for preventing infections after the corona pandemic.
Mm.
It's, wearing masks, washing hands, being aware of, you know, contact with a lot of people. That usually can prevent. I mean, we've seen in the emergency room a massive decrease in the numbers of patients presenting with infectious diarrhea. Normally we have a diarrhea sure. season, and it's just really gone away, and I think it's because of the coronavirus intervention.
So it is.
It's quite unexpected. I think, yeah, as traveling, one should avoid drinking, obviously, funny water and funny food. Traveler's diarrhea is also, you get infectious traveler's diarrhea, and sometimes you get a little bit of light diarrhea, which is just an adjustment to a new environment. Which is also to be expected. But what you're talking about in terms of prevention is to prevent the infectious traveler's diarrhea, the E. coli or things like that. And that's with good hand washing, avoiding, you know, contaminated eating places and trying to make sure that the water that you drink is clean.
We've had a message in from Miriam who says we're due to visit our daughter in Mumbai next year. Not sure if we will because of COVID. Yeah, I see. But if we do, please ask your guest to explain what is the difference between routine, recommended and required vaccines? Okay, thanks for that, Miriam. Routine, required and recommended vaccines. Do you not just have a list of vaccines that you have to get, Dr. Dandry, and that's it?
As far as my understanding is, I'm not a travel specialist, but as far as my understanding, a routine vaccine is what's given on the World Health Organization schedule in childhood. A recommended vaccine, required vaccines are vaccines that are required by the country that you're going to in order to issue with a visa and to allow you to pass passport control. It usually covers things like yellow fever. A recommended vaccine is a vaccine that people may recommend, particularly if it wasn't on the schedule, against things such as rotavirus. So those are in addition to what is legally required for entry into the country.
Right. Okay.
And again, I think that's something that's best to be discussed with your physician in terms of your own risk profile and your own tolerance for illness in that. Obviously, as one becomes older, if one has other comorbidities, it might be prudent to take the recommended vaccines as well. To avoid getting those infections.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, well, Miriam, not sure whether you will be going or not at this stage, but thanks very much for your message. Stuart says, SJ, please ask Dr. Shah. It's not Dr. Shah this week. Why is it that whenever I fly long haul, I get a terrible sore throat in the days after? It doesn't matter where I travel to. You and me both, Stuart. What's the explanation for that, Dr. Dandry? Is there an explanation for it, or do we just have weak immune systems?
I think that's a nice. It's a good question. I'm not entirely sure. I think it does have to do with the air conditioning on the plane, that one is being exposed to air that is not entirely normal air like you'd find in your environment. It's at a controlled temperature and a controlled humidity, and that can induce some inflammation in the throat that takes a couple of days to settle.
Yeah, because I'm with you, Stuart. I struggle enormously, and I always have done. Whenever, and it doesn't matter, like you say, it doesn't matter where I go, I really struggle with a sore throat and swollen glands in the days after taking, particularly a long-haul flight. It's infuriating. All right, medication. What are some of the things that we need to consider when it comes to medication and travelling, Doctor? Because presumably there will be issues in terms of what we can take, taking one's prescription. What are some of the things that we might want to consider?
So it is a good idea to travel with some basic medication. I mean,
right.
Getting healthcare in a foreign country is not only challenging, but it's also quite frightening because you're not sure how the payment structure works.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a friend who was told, a surfer who was in South America somewhere, and he was shown an x-ray of his broken arm and they wanted to take him for surgery. And he wasn't comfortable being operated in South America, so he flew home with his broken arm, and had x-rays at home, and the x-ray was normal. So one should just, if you have a bad feeling, sure, you know, go with it. I'm not advocating don't trust the doctors and that, but don't be a sucker either.
My goodness me.
I think in terms of medication, it's important to remember, number one is the laws regarding carrying medication across borders, particularly patients who might have chronic pain syndromes, who perhaps are using opiates or restricted medication. It's important to have proof that this is something that was prescribed by your doctor at home, so that you can't be charged with, you know, traveling with illicit medications across borders. Then I think it's worthwhile keeping some simple pain medication. Things like Panado and Brufen are usually very effective for the headache, for that sore throat. They're quite good at stopping the inflammation. And then some medication to assist with nausea and diarrhea is probably not a bad idea. There's some pretty good medications on the market at the moment that you can just dissolve under the tongue that can actually stop a person from vomiting and having nausea, particularly when you're traveling, you get the traveler's diarrhea or gastro. If you can stop the vomiting, it actually allows you to ride out the storm much, much more effectively.
Yeah, okay.
A lot of people like to travel with antibiotics. I'm not a big fan of that. I think, you know, one of the problems, one of the healthcare challenges we face at the moment is excessive use of antibiotics. And I think it's best to be discussed with your physician. But there are a couple, for example, if someone's going into northern Mozambique or deep, India is actually pretty good for drugs. Most of our drugs come from there anyway.
Right.
But if you're going to an environment where there's not ready access to medication, then it might be a good idea just to take some antibiotics, things like Ciprobay or azithromycin, but discuss with your physician and obviously get it on script, because, you know, it's important to use antibiotics judiciously.
We've had a question in from Daphne in Joburg. It says, morning, SJ. I'm 14 weeks pregnant and hoping to travel to see my parents in Cape Town at Christmas. I'll be around 26 weeks by then. What are some of the things I should take into account flying while pregnant? And would it be better to drive down over a couple of days? Ah, oh, Daphne, I was in your shoes this time last year, flying while pregnant. I'll be honest, Daphne, it wasn't enormously fun. I will say that for nothing. If you can afford to upgrade, do it. But that's just that's my own personal comment there. Dr. Danjir, what would be your suggestion?
Yeah, I think congratulations on being pregnant. Firstly, I think it's. Now, you've got to weigh the risks. So traveling down over a few days, taking a road trip is good fun. I wouldn't recommend driving down, trying to do it in 1 or 2 days, because as a pregnant patient, you actually have a slightly increased risk of developing DVTs earlier. It's one of the categories I actually forgot to mention. So if it's going to be short trips, flying might be safer because it's just a two-hour flight from Joburg to Cape Town. And again, the recommendation I'd make is, you know, make sure that you keep hydrated. And ensure that you, I wouldn't recommend taking an aspirin if you're pregnant, but just make sure you keep hydrated, perhaps wear DVT stockings. And one thing that's important that we often run into challenges with every December is, as far as possible, try bring your medical record with you, particularly, you know, a contact number for your obstetrician back home. If they've given you a road to health chart, antenatal chart with what the progress has been so far. Because if you do run into trouble and need to seek healthcare this side, it's much easier for the doctors if they have your history.
For sure.
From back home.
Yeah, absolutely. And all the very best to you, Daphne. Yeah. memories of long-haul travel while pregnant are making me shift awkwardly in my seat. Have we got time for one more question? Yes. What are the signs that someone has malaria? Good question. Thank you.
So, malaria can be tricky. It can present with a person can be completely clapped out and sick, but it can also present just like a flu-like illness. So the particular sign is a fever that's coming and going, but unfortunately a lot of conditions cause fever. But one of the classical signs of malaria is a fever that can actually get quite high. A patient experiences rigor, so that's where you feel cold and you start shaking. But if you check the temperature, it's actually usually sitting around 39, 40, 41. Headache can be a sign of malaria. The old school, and hopefully we usually pick up malaria before, what they call black water fever, where the kidneys pack up and the urine looks like Coke. the important things with malaria is to be aware of the risk and aware if one has been in a malaria area. Take the prophylaxis and also don't ignore the cold or flu symptoms if you have potentially been exposed to malaria, been in a malaria area, because when malaria is, the treatment is delayed, that's when patients develop what we call severe malaria.
Right.
There's very effective treatment for malaria at the moment called IV artesunate, which is available in almost all hospitals across the country. However, the sooner you pick up malaria and treat it, the better it is for the patient. Okay. Even with the best treatment, sometimes if the malaria is advanced, it can still lead to death or prolonged ICU stays.
Okay, thank you very much indeed for that question. That's all we've got time for. Our guest this morning has been Dr. Ibrahim Dandria. Thank you so much for joining us. He is an emergency medical specialist and head of unit at Life Vincent Pilotti. Thank you so much for your questions. Dr. Shah will be back next week.